Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. There's crime in this hour. Later on, a story from yours truly, Johnny Deller. But right now, the first of a two-part story of Nick Harris Detective. We'll enjoy back-to-back broadcasts of the story, The Young Shoplifter. The first, a syndicated broadcast, heard on July 1st, 1938.
Presenting Detective Nick Harris in a salute to the law. Ladies and gentlemen, we bring you Detective Nicholas B. Harris, chief of the internationally known Los Angeles detective agency bearing his name in one of his dramatizations of true life crime stories, proving to the youth of today the folly of committing crime.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Ladies and gentlemen, time and again I have repeated the statement that crime does not pay, whether the criminal is one who has committed murder or petty larceny. Still, he cannot win against the combined forces of a decent social order and the law enforcement officers. And the story I have chosen to now dramatize serves to once more emphasize the point in question. So as we draw back the curtains of this true life drama, which I have entitled A Young Shoplifter, let us trail the career of a young girl who got started down the wrong road of life. For the purpose of this story, we will call her Pearl Lachey. I first heard of her one spring afternoon some years ago when the tingling of my telephone bell... Hello?
I'm sorry, Mr. Harris, but Mr. Newdell insists she must talk to you.
Well, all right, put her on.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Here she is. Mr. Lewis.
Yes, Mr. Newdell, what is it?
I just caught a very young girl stealing a pair of silk stockings.
Well, turn her over to the police.
Oh, but I don't want to do that. She's so young, and the owner of the store says he will not prosecute.
Well, then take her home or let her go.
Mr. Harris, I think something could be done with this child if you would talk to her or her family. Won't you go with us to our home? She's crying. I can't do a thing either.
All right, Marie. I'll meet you in front of the building in 10 minutes. A petty thief. With uncontrollable love for pretty things, I suppose.
Mr. Harris, here are those papers in that case. I got them just as quickly as I
could. Yes, thank you very much. But put them on my desk. I've got a call to go out.
Yes, sir.
This is Marie DeNuzzo. She's got a young girl shoplifter and wants me to see what I can do.
Oh, Mr. Nuzzo again?
Yeah, and I hate to turn her down. Any person Marie wants to help is usually worth helping. And this time, well, we'll see and make note of any calls while I'm on.
Yes, sir.
All right, Pearl. Along with Mr. Nuzzo and me, right up to your doorstep.
I'm awfully sorry, sir. I'll never do it again. Honest, I won't.
We hope you mean that.
Why do I do? But, Mr. Harris...
Yes, anyone?
Do you have to go up to the door, to my house with me? Can't you leave me here on the walk? I hate for Margaret and Blanche to know.
Well, better your family know than the police.
Oh. Listen, Pearl, and don't cry. You said your mother was a widow and that she worked daytime. Well, she won't be here now. And your youngest sister, Blanche, won't understand much about it anyway. Oh, come along, my dear. We're only trying to keep you out of more serious trouble.
But you see, Margaret, she sort of takes care of all of us while Mother's working. And she's older than I am. And oh, if she just didn't have to
know. Yeah, but she's going to know, Pearl, so... Come along with us.
Pearl, Pearl, what's the matter? Why, you're crying.
Oh, Margaret,
your name is Lachey. Margaret Lachey.
Yes, who are you people?
I'm Marie DeNuzzo, facial department store operator. This is Detective Harris.
Oh, we're just bringing your sister home.
Yes, Miss Lachey, instead of taking her to jail.
Jail?
She was caught stealing a pair of expensive silk stockings. More expensive than I imagined she could have paid for.
Pearl, come into the house.
Margaret, don't Don't be too hard on me. I didn't mean to. I didn't.
Get into your room and stay there. Oh. Just you wait till Mom gets home. She'll give you a good licking that you won't forget.
I'm sorry we had to do this, Margaret.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure that Pearl will never do anything like this again.
Miss Lachey, it's because we hope she won't. Because we hope that this scare may be the only lesson she needs that we brought her home to you. Now, the responsibility is mostly yours and your mother's. Come, Mr. Nuzzo. I've got to hurry back to the office.
All right, Mr. Harris. Goodbye, Margaret. And I hope everything turns out all right.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you both.
Months pass, and all thoughts of Pearl Lachey, the young shoplifter, have vanished. However, one afternoon in the late fall of the same year...
Mr. Hempstead, you asked me to come down here to your store. What did you want to see me about?
Well, Mr. Harris, I have a cashier whom I believe is taking money from us somehow. So far, I haven't been able to actually catch her at it. I have strong suspicions. I wonder if you'd shadow her and see if there's anything to it.
Surely, Mr. Hempstead, where'll I find your suspect working?
It's the main floor at the cashier's box, along the hosiery counter.
Very well. I'll go outside now and come back in from the street. I'll simply be a shop, understand, Mr. Hempstead? So it's Pearl Lachey again. Well, I'll have a little chat with her and see what... Hello, Pearl.
Oh, Mr. Harris. What are you doing here? Checking up on me?
No, just shopping. I happened to see you, so I thought I'd speak to you.
Oh, sure.
How do you like your new job?
Oh, I like it lots. I've been behaving myself, too, just like I promised I would.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, Pearl. Just keep straight and you'll never regret it. You've got to be going now, so goodbye.
And goodbye, Mr. Harris.
The Monarch Department Store had a new clerk, Mrs. Lillian Brooks from the Harris office. And this special operative noted that Pearl Lachey forgot to ring up several sales. However, as yet, Lillian Brooks hadn't discovered the girl's method of making away with the money not registered. But after working hours, detailed to Shadow Pearl when away from the store were Lulu Lane and Hazel Gordon, two other special women operatives. And as they began their vigilance, they noted...
Hazel, look. She's meeting someone. That chap with only one arm. See the grin on his face and the happy smile on hers?
Yes.
Who is he? Do you know him, Lulu?
Oh, that's Charles Stevens, that dirty rat, Hazel. He works for the department stores on the lookout for young girls just out of school. He's been up several times on such charges.
Well, he seems to be a very good friend of our little suspect right now. Come on. There they go into the crowd. We're following that pair all night, isn't it?
The following morning...
Hello?
Mr. Harris, this is Hazel Gordon. We trailed Pearl Lachey nearly all night. She didn't go home until almost 4 this morning.
Anything else, Hazel?
Yes, she's going with Charles Beavers. They hit all the night spots they planned for. Dancing, drinking, all the rest. Then he took her home. To a new place where she seems to live alone. No clues yet.
Okay, keep right after.
And the morning following that...
Yes? What is it?
Hazel Gordon again, Mr. Harris. Lulu Lane and I followed Pearl Lachey again last night. But it's the same story. Around the right spot with young beavers. That's all.
All right, Hazel. Don't give up.
Several nights of vigil by the two women investigators brought nothing more to light. But during working hours, Pearl Lachey was not so successful in hiding her undercover activities. For Mrs. Lillian Brooks, the operative posing as a new clerk, made a startling discovery.
And now, Miss Lane and Miss Gordon, Pearl Lachey put the money she failed to ring up in a small cardboard box under the counter.
Oh, so that's it, Mrs. Brooks.
Yes, she keeps her makeup there, too, to hide the coins.
Pretty clever.
But every once in a while, usually about this time of the morning, she goes to the restroom and there destroys the sales slips which balance against the amount she steals.
She also transfers the money to her person.
Look, she's leaving the counter now.
Yes, and the little cardboard box is under her arm. That's our cue, girls. Come on, let's go and get the police. And there'll be three of us who can testify as witnesses.
Mr. Hempstead, so you refuse to prosecute?
Yes, Mr. Harrow. That girl, well, blame it. She's a darned youngin. We'll let her go. She can't work here anymore. No, sir, she can't do that.
Another year passed, the year in which no word of Pearl O'Shea was heard. Perhaps the little shoplifter had reformed. But one day, reappearing out of a clear sky, Pearl was once more seen by Lulu Lane, seen and trailed, as she was entering one of Los Angeles' smartest department stores, and her companion was the debonair Charles Devers.
Is this the floor, dear?
Yes, Charles. Oh, here comes the clerk now.
May I help you?
Yes. You see, we're going to be married soon, and I'd like to select a wedding gown.
Oh, a wedding gown? Won't you step this way, please?
Certainly. Come along, Charles.
All right, darling.
Now, here are several lovely gowns that I'm sure you'll be interested in.
Oh, that one. Charles, do you like it?
Well, Pearl, I believe I prefer that one there.
Well, then I'll try them both on and see which you like the best.
Yes, just step this way, please.
All right, then. We'll leave it that way. We'll make the $5 deposit now, and tomorrow I'll bring my mother down to see the gown. I'm crazy about it myself.
That wedding gown, where is it? Have any of you clerks seen it?
Honey, hurry. Let's get going. The head saleswoman's wise, I think. Come on.
Oh, yes. We'll be back tomorrow. Goodbye.
Thank you, Miss.
Miss Harper, have you seen that gown? That pearl-trimmed wedding gown? Oh, it's gone.
Why, it was there, in the dressing room, just a moment ago.
No, you must be mistaken. It's nowhere to be found. And I have a customer ready to take it. A debutante, one of our most important customers. She saw it yesterday and she wants it. Oh, where is it?
I don't know. But I do know that gown was there. That young woman who just left, the one with the young man, well, she just tried it on. It couldn't have vanished into thin air.
But it has. It has. And we've got to find it. That gown, Miss Hopper, was valued at $500.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you may guess, and rightfully enough, that Pearl O'Shea stole the wedding gown valued at $500. But how did she do it? And how was she caught with the goods upon her own person? Well, remember, Miss Lula Lane saw every move of what you have just heard enacted upon our radio stage. And therefore, but suppose we bring you the conclusion of this story next week. Because there's a strong moral lesson yet to be pointed out in the case of Pearl O'Shea.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard another true life story brought to you by Detective Nicholas B. Harris, internationally famous Los Angeles criminologist and chief of the detective agency bearing his name. Although this was a true story, fictitious names and places have been used throughout this narrative. The Nick Harris program will again be heard over this station next Friday evening at 8:45. We invite you to tune in at that time and hear the concluding episode of the true crime story, The Young Shoplifter. This is Frank Russell speaking.
Nick Harris, detective, on Tuned to Yesterday from July 1st, 1938, a syndicated broadcast featuring a very rare radio appearance from Nick Harris, the detective himself, who basically was the country's second big-name detective, the first being Alan Pinkerton in the 1850s, and at the turn of the century, Nick Harris founded his own agency and later a detective school, which, at the time of this recording, has solved over a million cases to date. Next, the character of Nick Harris will solve the young shoplifter case in part two of a syndicated episode from July 8, 1938.
Presenting Detective Nick Harris in a salute to the law. Ladies and gentlemen, once again we bring you Detective Nicholas B. Harris, chief of the internationally known Los Angeles detective agency bearing his name, in a dramatization of one of his true crime stories, proving to the youth of today the folly of committing crime. Gentlemen, often I have repeated that the criminal cannot win in the long run. And this evening, as we continue to unfold the true life account of Pearl Lachey, the young blonde shoplifter, we shall see more clearly than ever the truth of my statement. Now, Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Russell, and good evening, everyone. You will remember last week that Pearl Lachey had an overwhelming desire for things that were pretty, an expensive luxury which, as a young girl, she had been denied. And so Pearl fell into the habit of picking up from department store counters such articles as high-priced silk hose, costly hats, and many similar items. Last week, we traced her early career from a petty theft of an expensive pair of silk stockings to a more serious offense of shortchanging a large department store. And we finally left her in the act of stealing a $500 wedding gown from one of the city's smartest stores. But as Pearl Lachey left the store, with a frantic saleswoman trying to trace the lost gown, Lula Lane, one of my best women operators, followed. Out in the street, Miss Lane approached Pearl Lachey and her shifty, one-armed escort, Charles Devers.
Pearl, hurry up. I think a woman Dick spotted in the store. I don't know, but...
Oh, I ain't afraid of them. I've had dealings with them before. And besides, Charles...
Calm the chatter and come along with me quick.
All right.
Wait a minute, Pearl.
Oh, what do you want, you?
I want that $500 wedding gown you've got stuffed inside your clothing. Come with me. Both of you. If you try to get away, you won't make it. There's a plain clothes bird watching us now.
Might as well give up, Pearl. They've got us.
Okay, Miss Lane. I remember you from before. But someday I'm going to shake you for good.
I sentence you to 6 months in jail for attempted theft. Charles Devers, this court can prove nothing against you at this time, and so you may go free.
And thus Pearl Lachey, innocent-looking blonde shoplifter, served her first jail term. During this period, downtown Los Angeles department stores breathed a combined sigh of relief. But during her incarceration, I instructed my operators to become thoroughly familiar with Pearl's features. And upon her release, Hazel Gordon again took up her vigil, now aided by Isabel Carpenter, another shrewd woman operator. One day, the pair spotted Pearl sauntering along Broadway, dressed smartly and made up to kill.
That blonde with a Hollywood swagger and the thick coat of war paint?
Yes, she looks like you're working in pictures, doesn't she? You know, that extra girl attitude? Here I am all dialed up, look me over.
Well, from that past record of hers, she's up to something, you can be sure.
Yes, but what?
Come on, Hazel, let's follow her. Trailed that girl for 5 hours, Hazel, and we haven't seen a single suspicious action.
No, she just keeps going, does a little honest shopping, and stops at nearly every drugstore she passes.
At nearly every drugstore she passes. Say, Hazel, do you think she may be up to something with the drugstores now?
Oh, I don't know, but it's a hunch worth following up.
Yes, I think it is. Come along. We'll go in the next drugstore behind her.
Now, wait a minute. You go in behind her. She doesn't know you yet, and she knows me. We've had dealings before, you know, Isabel. Now, go ahead and keep close to her. I'll keep my distance from you till later on.
All right, here goes.
Yes, ma'am. What can I do for you?
Give me a 10-cent bottle of Paragard, please.
Paragard? Certainly, ma'am.
Oh, so that's it. She drinks Paragard. The whole bottle. I'll trail her farther on and make sure.
Yes, lady, what will you have?
Paragord, the 10-cent bottle.
All right, a bottle of Paragord.
Clerk, give me a 10-cent bottle of Paragord, quick. Please hurry.
So, Pearl Lachey is a dope addict.
Mr. Jerome, I didn't expect to see you here in this store.
Hello, Estelle. What are you doing? Keeping an eye out for shoplifters?
Well, Christmas is a good time for them. Besides, I do have a little shopping to do myself.
Mr. Yes. Jerome!
What? Oh, Hazel and Isabel. Well, what are you two up to?
Oh, we've been trailing Pearl Lachey again, Mr.
Pearl
Jerome.
Pearl Lachey?
Yes, and Isabel found out why she stops at nearly every drugstore she passes.
Well, tell
she
us
she buys a 10-cent bottle of Paragord, goes to the ladies' room, and drinks the contents of the bottle.
Then she's a dope fiend.
Yes.
I see. Well, why are you two here now?
Oh, well, Pearl's in here somewhere. We've lost her.
Well, get back on her trail. I'm just shopping, but Estelle and I'll keep our eyes open, too. Now, you two had better cover one of the other floors. We'll stick here on the main floor.
All right, Mr. Jerome.
We'll find her again if it takes all day.
Good, reliable pair, those two, Estelle.
Yes, and you can see those two are worn out tracking down their blonde shoplifter.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Miss Deming, what's the trouble?
Those girls, the two over there with the mirrors. I don't know for sure, but I think I saw them take a $20 hat from its pedestal.
What?
Yes, but I don't know where they put it. Why, it simply vanished.
All right, Miss Deming. You come with me.
Just a minute, Floorwalker. I'm a Harris detective. What's the matter here?
A detective?
Yes. And this young woman is Miss Graham, department store operative. My name's Jerome.
Well, then those two girls over there by that mirror near the hat counter. They've hidden an expensive hat somewhere.
Mr. Jerome, what shall we do? We haven't any actual proof. Yet Miss Deming saw them.
All right. Now, don't you or your clerk do anything. Just leave them to us. Come along, Estelle. We're shopping. You're the wife, and I'm the shop-worried husband. Come on, we'll go closer. Can't see their faces yet, Estelle.
I wish they'd turn around.
Well, go ahead and pretend to be looking at these hats here. I'll watch them.
Okay. Oh, look. Did you see that, Mr. Jerome?
Yes. Pretty slick. She slipped her old hat on that rack and put a new one on her head. Come on, Estelle. They're turning, ready to leave. We'll get them now.
Mr. Jerome, that girl stole another one of our hats just then. I saw her, and I'm going to grab her.
Just a minute, Mr. Floorwalker. Don't you know there's a law in this state that says an arrest for shoplifting can't be made until the suspect has shown intent to take, steal, and carry away the article in question?
Well, isn't that intent enough?
No, not until she takes it out of your store. Now, stay here. My operator and I will get her outside.
Mr. Jerome, look! That face! Is that the face of that girl
in
the blonde one?
Yes, it's Pearl Lachey. Come on, let's get her! All right, Estelle, you grab the other girl's arm. I'll take care of her.
Okay.
What's the big... Oh, God!
And you, Pearl Lachey, come along with us. We want you and those two hats you just took from the store.
So Pearl Lachey was once again arrested and convicted on charges of theft. And once more she went to prison. Her younger companion, in whose blouse was found the $20 hat first stolen, was sentenced to juvenile hall. And so twice, the young blonde shoplifter beat the law. Twice she had gone up for brief term. Another year passed. And then, with reports of stolen dresses coming into our office from other department stores, I detailed Estelle Graham. She was put back on the job. This time, she put to use a brand new idea, and this is how it worked out.
She went into that fitting room, Miss Graham.
I see, Mr. Jones. And you say you first saw her wearing a salesgirl's apron with a sales book in place, carrying the frock that way.
Yes, and I don't know that girl. I'm a floor walker here, you know, and I know on sight all of our clerks.
It's probably that Pearl Lachey again. Follow me. I've got a little gadget fixed up in all the fitting rooms here, Mr. Jones. Perhaps we shall discover something.
Miss Estelle Graham and the floor walker tiptoed to a secluded spot behind the fitting room just entered by this new suspect. And standing on a chair, Estelle looked into a small cylinder of an ingenious periscope she had fitted out for this very purpose.
You were right. It's a steal, and it's Pearl Lachey wrapping that frock around her waist. I'll nab her outside.
Lieutenant Parker, that rent receipt we found on Pearl brought us here. But under the doorbell outside, the name listed was Pearl Farley.
The same Pearl Lachey, says the landlady, Mr. Jerome.
But, Lieutenant, what about all these stolen luxuries here? Gowns, coats, jewelry. I wonder why she didn't sell them to a fence.
She didn't need to, Inspector. The landlady told me that Miss Farley, as Pearl Lachey called herself here, did sell these things. She had a swell trade with all the movie extras from Hollywood. Here, Mr. Jerome, is where they got their fancy wardrobes.
So that's it, huh? Sold this stuff to the extras, and probably dirt cheap, too.
That's right.
And thus, Pearl Lachey was put out of circulation for a third time. And after her release, nothing was again heard of her. Until about a year later.
Yes, this is the place, Lieutenant Parker.
Yeah, those Case brothers who robbed telephone boxes of nickels, dimes, and quarters gave this address for Ed Farley, the guy they said sold them the master key to open telephone.
Farley? Farley? Say, that brings something back to my mind. Come on, let's knock.
No answer. Here's a pass key.
Fine, let's have it. Well, nobody here. Let's look around, Parker.
Sure.
Wonder where this Ed Farley kept those... Wait, wait a minute. What's that?
A dame.
Pearl Lachey.
Oh!
Lieutenant, after her. Get her. Little devil, she's trying to get away. Pearl, get away from that window.
Get away from me! Take your
Inspector,
hands off me!
Inspector, she threw something out
what
of the window.
It, Pearl? You might as well tell. We'll search below anyhow.
Oh, come on, you know, Mr. Jerome, I don't want to go and stir again for that.
For what? Oh. I didn't ask you that. I want to know what you threw out of that window.
Oh, hi, Pearl.
Dope again, eh, Pearl? Well, come along with me. Right now, we want to know something about master keys that fit telephone coin boxes. You stay here and search the place, Parker.
And this nearly ended the case of Pearl Lachey, who was exonerated on the telephone coin box card, as she gave us information leading to the arrest of the maker of the master telephone box keys. But several months later, the final chapter of the blonde shoplifter was at last written in San Francisco. A telegram came through to me from that city, stating simply, Pearl Lachey, former morphine addict, now cocaine fiend, jumped from window of a San Francisco doctor's office, died instantly, a suicide. And that's all. And so, as I say to the youth of today again, this case also proves that crime does not pay.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the concluding chapter of another true life story brought to you by Detective Nicholas B. Harris, internationally famous Los Angeles criminologist and chief of the detective agency bearing his name. Although this was a true story, fictitious names and places have been used throughout this narrative. The story was dramatized by Howard W. Bull and produced under the direction of Carolyn Carroll, with Wesley Turtelot at the organ. Mr. Harris wishes me to thank the following cast for their participation in this program. Betty Carmine, Olive Thomas, Mary Ryan, Lenore Thompson, Marion O'Moore, Earl Hurt, George Conkling, Lawrence Travers, and Eric Loring. Mr. Harris will again be heard over this station next Friday evening at 8:45 in another interesting true life story entitled The Fatal Ace of Spades. This is Frank Russell speaking.
Nick Harris, detective, on Tuned to Yesterday, the conclusion of that two-part story from July 8, 1938. And now we wrap up this hour of crime on Tuned to Yesterday with an episode of yours truly, Johnny Deller, a CBS episode from July 9, 1961, called The Fiddle Faddle Matter.
Johnny Deller.
Hi, Johnny. This is Earl Foreman.
Earl.
You know, Tri-State Life and Casualty.
Sure, in dear old Los Angeles, California.
No.
I should say West Los Angeles.
No, sir.
Only I thought you'd given up the insurance business to retire out there in the Golden West.
No more,
Johnny.
You
were going to do nothing but laze around in that California sunshine, maybe play a little golf. Hey, wait a minute. Did I hear you throw in a no somewhere along the line there?
You sure did.
No to what?
California.
Huh?
I mean that Mike, my darling wife, and I are back home in Florida again.
No kidding.
No kidding. Right back here in Sarasota.
I'll be darned. When'd that happen?
couple of months ago. And by way of keeping out of mischief, I've taken over the tri-state office again.
Oh, I get it. You're back to your old habit of putting in a pitch for me to get on down there and do some fishing with you.
Maybe, among other things.
Other things like what?
Like insurance investigation. What else? How's your musical ear?
Well, I think I can tell the difference between a fiddle and a bass drum, if that's any help.
It may be, Johnny. It may be.
What's up, Earl?
As long as the company will pay your expenses, why don't you come on down here and see?
Okay. Why not?
The CBS Radio Network brings you Mandel Kramer in the exciting adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator,
yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the Tri-State Life and Casualty Insurance Company office in Sarasota, Florida. Following is an account of expenses incurred during my investigation of the Fiddle Faddle matter. Expense account item one, 7940 taxi out to Bradley Field and a plane heading south. The flight was quick and easy, and by early afternoon, I was in the office at 1306 Main Street that Earl shares with another old friend of mine, Don Boomhauer, a prominent real estate operator.
Don't let Earl kid you for 1 minute, Johnny.
What do you mean by that, Don?
Only real reason he wants you down here is to go fishing with him. And maybe in the hopes he can get you to settle down here, which wouldn't be such a bad idea, Johnny.
Now, stop making with the pitch, Don. You dig up Earl for me so I can get to work in his insurance problem.
Well, I tried.
And he did very well. Tell me, do you know anything about why he wants me down here?
I told you.
No, I mean about the job he has for me.
Oh, that. Well, Johnny, it's probably the most unimportant case anybody ever handed you. Did you ever hear of Mr. Joseph R. Tetrick?
Nope, never heard of him.
Real big in oil and steel and copper a while back. Came down here to retire. Built himself a big house at the north end of St. Armand's Key, really on Lido Shores.
And?
Well, that house of his includes an air-conditioned walk-in vault big enough for the average bank. And why?
Why?
It's to keep his collection of fiddles in.
Collection of fiddles?
That's right, violins. Fine, rare violins.
Oh, you must be quite a musician.
Nope, doesn't know a hemisemidem quaver from a G-string.
What'd you say?
I wouldn't know the difference myself, Johnny, so don't ask. But that collection is his one pride and joy in life. A couple of genuine Strads. You heard of a Stradivarius, haven't you?
And everybody?
Plus one called an Amati and a Paganini or a Pagliacci or whatever it is, and a Guarnerius and... Oh, boy, that collection must be worth hundreds of thousands, Johnny.
Well, what's happened?
Well, now, the one he cares about most is Bissiak.
Never heard of that one.
Well, now, apparently this man Bissiak over in Italy, and not too long ago at that, made a whole raft of real good fiddles, you know, worth $1,000, $2,000 a piece.
Mm-hmm. I'll take your word for it.
But this one, they call it the Canary on account of its almost yellow color. Unlike the others he made, this one, the one Tetrick had, was just about the finest that he ever... Well, anyhow, Earl insured it for $10,000.
Get to the point, Don.
Well, like he always does every couple of months, and I mean with all those good fiddles, you know, Tetrick took the Bissiak to a fiddle maker for a kind of a checkup, just to make sure it was still strung up properly and okay and all, you know.
Well, you say that he doesn't play himself.
No, not a note, sweet or sour.
Seems like an awful waste.
Yes, I know. It's a waste of all of them. But anyhow, he took the Bissiak to this man for his regular checkup.
Took it to whom, Don?
He's an old Italian, name of Antonio Di Polito. And he's been down here over a year now, has his little shop at the end of Palm Avenue.
Di Polito?
Yeah, Di Polito. Anyhow, he took the fiddle to him yesterday, and this morning early, the police found the place broken into, old man Di Polito on the floor, still out from a bang on the head, and of course, that Bissiak fiddle was gone.
Mm-hmm. Have the police any leads on who got into that shop and how?
Nary a one, Johnny. But...
Yeah.
Now, about 2 hours ago, Tetrick called Earl up on the phone and told him to hop on out to his home on the quay, that he was certain he had the answer to the whole thing.
That's where Earl is now.
Huh? Yes. And if you ask me, if Tetrick does know who did it, you've wasted your time coming down here.
Well, I better try calling Earl at the Tetrick place. You mind if I use this phone?
Wait a minute. Hold everything, Johnny. Don't bother. He's just parked his car out front.
Oh, good. What's the matter with him?
Oh, yes. He does look kind of funny, doesn't he?
Hi, Earl. How are you? I should say, what's all the gloom about?
Well, hi, Johnny. I'm glad you got down here so fast.
Tell me, Earl, did old man Tetrick really know who took his fiddle and how and why, like he said he did on the phone?
I guess he must have done. I guess he must have.
Must have?
Yes, Johnny. By the time I got out there to his place, Tetrick was dead. No, murdered.
Earl Perman got back to his office to tell us about the murder of Joseph Tetrick. The Sarasota police had arrived there, and a full-scale investigation was underway. Results so far, nothing. Apparently, someone Tetrick knew had gone to see him. There were no signs of the house having been broken into. He'd let them in himself and got slugged to death with just one blow with a heavy crystal ashtray. But the police had found no fingerprints, no clues of any kind, not yet.
So, if you want to go on over there and talk with the police... Well, it might be a good idea, Johnny.
Yeah, I suppose so. Don, Earl, either of you have an extra car I can use for a while?
Oh, sure, Johnny, sure. Here, take these keys. It's the light tan job out in the back there.
Thanks, Don.
Oh, better still, I'll drive you over there, Johnny.
No, Earl. To where I'm going, I think I'd rather go alone. The little shop of Antonio DiPolito... There at the end of Palm Avenue was just that. Little and dirty and thoroughly cluttered with the tools of his trade. In the dusty fly-specked window, he had half a dozen or so dark brown, cheap violins in a stack of fiber cases. Inside, on a couple of shelves serving as a counter, was the usual stock of strings, rosin, mutes, and so on. Mr. DiPolito sat behind his workbench, a bandage around his head, concentrating on a refinishing job on the fiddle in his lap. Now, let me say again that I'm no expert, but it did strike me that he was doing a rather good job with the varnish that he so carefully, painstakingly applied.
He's a kid. He's a crazy kid.
The body of the violin took on a sort of old-world patina under his expert hand.
These are children. They get us so careless. They drop the violin, they make it a crack in the belly.
That's a good violin, Mr. DiPolito?
It's maybe $150, $250, but it's too good for the kid. He don't take care of him. So I got to fix up. Well, and the varnish, then he's to look like a $500.
Yeah, it looks pretty good.
Hey. Now I'm hang it up to here. And he's dry. Yeah. And now, what am I going to do for you, mister?
I'm an insurance investigator, Mr. DiPolito.
Oh. Oh, yes. It's a terrible thing. Yes, that did happen last night. Beesiac, the beautiful, beautiful canary beesiac.
I call it canary because of its color, I understand.
Yeah.
Because it had sort of a yellowish cast to it,
And because of the way it could sing, like only the most beautiful violin of a master can sing. Only my own boy, my young Antonio. Yeah, but now the violin is gone. What a terrible thing.
You want to tell me what happened to the beesiac?
I was working on it, Mr.
Dollar, Johnny Dollar.
You see, I was alone. It was very late. And because it was the beautiful beesiac, I'm pulling down the shades in at the front. I locked the door, just like I'm telling the police, so that nobody would see me in here so late.
Yes?
And I'm, I guess I fall asleep. And then I'm wake up, because I'm hearing somebody in behind me.
Could you see who it was?
By the time I'm turning my head, he's a hit to me, and a hit to me. I'm an honest. Only he's a daylight. And I'm going to see the police when he's a bang-bang on the front door, so I'm going to let him in.
Well, the door was still locked then?
Yes, yes.
And he'd come up behind you?
Yes. From the window in the back of the room.
Mm-hmm.
Come, I'm going to show you where he's a break open at the window while I'm asleep.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Now, here. You see where he cut the glass? Where he make it the hole to reach in and lock the window?
Used a glass cutter and probably some tape to keep the glass from falling and waking you.
That's what the police says.
Looks like the work of an amateur, though.
Why you say that, Mr. Dollar?
Well, you see, instead of a clean, round stroke with a glass cutter, he made a whole flock of straight scratches with it. You see him?
Huh?
You feel that?
Yeah.
The kind of clumsy grooves that he cut?
See, senor. But he sneak in and he hit me.
Now, Mr. DiPolito.
Yes?
Like I've said a couple of times now, I don't know very much about these things. But you tell me, where could a violin, a fine violin like that,
Where would a person be able to buy one?
Well, these here...
I mean, surely a little place like this of yours wouldn't sell them.
Oh, no.
At least if those you have in the window are any sample of the stock you'd carry.
Oh, no. Fine violin is like a fine jewel.
That's exactly what I'm thinking of. And it's a lot more conspicuous. So whoever stole a thing like the Disiac would either have to hide it away for years or get rid of it immediately before the alarm was out.
Mm.
The only place I know of that would handle a fine violin...
Girl!
Yeah, I kind of thought you might be coming over here. Feeling any better, DiPolito?
See, thank you, Mr. Bowman.
Good. The only place I know of that would trade in a fiddle like the Disiac and those Strads and the rest, well, as a matter of fact, that's where old Tetrick got all his violins.
Where?
The famous Wurlitzer collection up in Chicago.
Sure.
I could be wrong, but the way I understand it, practically all the great violins in the world have passed through their hands.
Okay, then. I'm on expense account, right?
Well, of course, but Johnny, what just happened to Mr. Tetrick is far more important than the fiddle right now.
Or is the fiddle the key to that murder?
Murder?
I'll leave Don's car here.
Huh?
That is, if you'll drive me out to the airport. Item 2 is 7905, plane fare to Chicago. I had a late dinner and spent the night at the Blackstone Hotel. That's item 3. Call it, $15 even. In the morning, within 5 minutes of the time they opened for business, I was talking with one of the experts at the Wurlitzer collection.
Well, of course, Mr. Dollar, we'll immediately notify every one of our branches, too, New York, Los Angeles, and so on, to be on watch for that Bissiac.
Good.
And, of course, we'll let you know right away if it shows up. Beyond that, however, I don't know what we can do.
Well, I'm afraid I don't either.
Terrible shame if it's got into the wrong hands. Only a true artist could do justice to that violin, but then, of course, no such artist would dare to use it.
Why do you say that?
Well, because it's now known to be stolen, too easily identified because of its unique, almost yellow color.
Oh, I see.
Poor Emil will be heartbroken when he learns of this.
Emil?
Emil Victor. Once owned it, played it in concerts all over the world before he brought it to us and we sold it to Mr. Tetrick.
Tell me, why did this Emil Victor ever sell it?
Well, you didn't know? Tragic accident to his hands that also left him blind?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I didn't know. Matter of fact, I'm afraid that I never even heard of Mr. Emil. Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Yeah?
That name, of course.
Emil?
No, no. Oh, son of a gun, I knew that name had rung a bell.
Oh, who's Mr. Dollar?
How stupid can I be?
I'm afraid I don't.
Listen, Emil Victor played that Bissiac for years, hmm?
Oh, 15 or 20 at least.
All right, then blind or not, he'd recognize it immediately if he heard it.
But I thought you just said Emil's was not the name that rang a bell, so to speak.
Don't you worry about that. Just tell me where I can find this Emil Victor and get me a list of concert bookings anywhere, anywhere in this country.
Concert bookings? Now, I don't understand.
You will when I recover that Bissiac. Item 4 is 420 for a couple of phone calls to Earl Pullman. Yes, the man I was now looking for had been in Sarasota on a brief stopover before resuming a concert tour. Okay, now with the help of the concert schedule, I knew where he was going to play next. That very night, as a matter of fact. Item 5, $1.90 for a cab to the flat where the once famous violinist, poor, blind, old Emil Victor, lived. I told him about my suspicions, of what I planned to do with his help.
But I cannot believe it, Mr. Bower, that a fine young musician could... And that his own father... And perhaps he didn't know what he was saying.
Because of that bang in the head? Who really knows how hard he was hit? Maybe that wallop on the head was faked.
But if he was unconscious the rest of the night...
Well, that's what he says. Who can prove otherwise? Look, he distinctly told me the shades were down so that no one could see him working on the Bissiac.
I see.
Yet later... Later, he told me that when he came to, he could see the cop, could see him outside knocking on the door.
Mr. Dollar.
Now, one of those statements is false, but I really deserve a kick in the pants because of those scratches, because I didn't get wise to them right then and there.
Scratches, Mr. Dollar?
Yes, from a glass cutter on the window in the back of the shop to make it look like that was the way somebody had got in there. But don't you see, I could feel them. I could feel the grooves there with my fingernail on the inside of that window.
But that only proves...
And another thing... Now, I don't know how much the old man knows about fixing fiddles, but when it comes to refinishing them, he is great. That much I saw for myself. refinish, recolor, call it whatever you like. But my biggest boner was in failing to pick up the cue when he was talking about the Bissiac.
What do you mean?
He said, if only my own boy, my young Antonio. Don't you see what he was trying to get across was if only his own boy could play a fiddle like that. He tried to plant the idea that the boy never would.
But, Mr. Dollar...
Let's go, Mr. Vitton.
But don't you see, if it was as you suspect, if the boy, if young Antonio does have it, if his father did change the color...
That's exactly what I'm betting on.
But then who could prove it's the canary Bissiac?
Are you kidding? You.
Me?
Come on, we got to get to a plane to that concert in El Paso tonight. Item 6, 172.50, taxi to the airport, then plane fares for the two of us to Fort Worth and a hop westward to El Paso. There, thanks to a captain of police, our tickets for the symphony concert cost us nothing because, yes, the soloist for the evening was young Antonio DiPolito. I'll say this for him. The short, dark, intense-looking kid could really play beautifully on the rather reddish-brown-colored violin that he used. Well, I knew.
Yes, Mr. Bell. It is the Bissiac. I am sure.
Absolutely sure?
How could I be mistaken when that instrument of heaven was my own for so many years?
Okay.
Would a father not recognize his own child? And I tell you, the Bissiac was far closer to me than a child could ever be. It was a part of me, as much as my own hands and mind and spirit are a part of me. From the first note that young Antonio played, I knew it was the Bissiac.
Good.
Even though it does not quite sound the same as it did.
What do you mean?
Because of the varnish he must have used, the old man, to change the color.
Mm-hmm.
There is a dryness to the tone that was not there before. It is just as robust, as commanding, as tone as ever. Yet there is a dryness, too, that only I will hear. But it is the Bissiac, the canary Bissiac. Of that there can be no question.
Okay, then, come on. We'll pick up the police and wait for him in his dressing room. After the concert was finished, there in the dressing room when he was faced with the facts as I now knew them, temperamental young Antonio screamed and fought like a tiger. Literally had to be held down by the police. But then when the old master Emil tore into him and really put his heart in it, the kid broke down and confessed. Not only to theft of the fiddle with his father's help, but to the murder of Mr. Tetrick. It seems that Tetrick had called him in to tell him that he suspected him. And when Tetrick picked up the phone and called Earl Pullman, Tony struck him down and killed him.
So I told you. I've told you everything. So you can take me away. You can kill me, too. But he deserved to die.
Did he, Tony?
Keeping such a priceless instrument locked up in a vault. It had to be played and played and played as only a true artist like me can play it. To thrill an audience with the warmth and color and sound that only I, Antonio, can bring from anything I touch. And now, thanks to you, I shall play no more.
No?
All this talent of mine, this matchless technique wasted. All the years that my father spent working, begging, even stealing so that I could study. And the hours and days and years of practice that I spent developing this wonderful gift that I have wasted.
Is it?
But it's the world that loses. Never again will an audience be able to feel the outpouring of my soul in the music of my violin. Without an audience to feel the power of my every note, I shall play no more.
Why not, Tony?
What?
Well, if an audience is all you need, seems to me that where you're going, you can be pretty sure of a captive one. So, from here on out, it's up to the courts. And that means for his father, too. You know, I wonder if the Tetrick estate will put the priceless fiddles in that collection in the hands of musicians where they can be used and appreciated. I hope so. Expense account total, including back to Chicago with Emil Victor and the trip home, That is, after a few days of fishing with Earl Perman back in Sarasota. 68180. Yours truly, Johnny Dolan.
Now, here is our star to tell you about next week's story.
Next week, the old-fashioned murder matter. As if there was anything new-fashioned about it. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, is written by Jack Johnstone. Produced and directed by Bruno Zerato, Jr. Musical supervision by Ethel Huber. Johnny Dollar is played by Mandel Kramer. Also heard in our cast were Santos Ortega as Dipolito, Leon Janney as Emil Victor, Richard Holland as Tony, Frank Behrens as Don Boomauer, Sam Gray as Earl Poorman, and Bill Lipton as the violin expert. Be sure to join us next week, same time, same station, for another exciting story of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. This is Art Hanna speaking. Word and speed, the last for accuracy, expanded CBS News on the CBS Radio Network.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 9th of July, 1961 on CBS. And so closes this hour of crime on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. It's been a pleasure.